Master, thank you for those kind words. And I'd like to start by thanking the college for this kind invitation. It's an enormous honor and privilege, especially when I look back at the very distinguished list of previous speakers who've spoken before me. Thank you also to colleagues, friends, and students who are here in the audience. You've chosen to spend your evening listening to me, and I'm deeply grateful for that. So I have spent just over 20 years as part of this wonderful community that is Fitzwilliam College. In 1998, when I came back to Cambridge, I have to admit, I was not very familiar with Fitz and what makes it such a special place. And perhaps equally knew even less about geography. These two institutions have been such a dominant part of my life ever since. And colleagues have really welcomed me into both communities with open arms. So I want to thank you for your generosity, for accepting this interloper into your worlds. I could not have asked for a more supportive environment. It's a really important year in the cycle that defines our lives here in Cambridge, with the college celebrating 150 years, this being 50 years since this set of foundation lectures were first delivered. It's also the centenary of the geographical tripos, which we celebrated at the department earlier this summer. So for me, it's a particular privilege to be asked to speak on this special occasion, which marks these twin anniversaries and also connects these two parts of my academic work here in Cambridge. Now to the title of my lecture, which I was asked to provide several months ago, well before I had properly formulated my thoughts on the subject. So it works at several levels. At one level, I think it speaks to the spatial contrast of the places where I've had the privilege to work, going from the highest mountain range on the planet to the low-lying fenlands of East Anglia, most threatened by the prospect of the climate emergency and sea level rise. It also provides a temporal chronological account of my research, so it helps me to structure the narrative of this evening's lecture through the multiple projects that I've had the privilege to be associated with. And finally, it's also intensely personal and autobiographical. It allows me to pay tribute to my wife, Shiraz, who's here in the audience. Like me, she spent many happy years living as a child and a young person in the Indian Himalayas, and has been an ever-present companion over the last 30 years as we've built our lives and our home and family in this small town in the Fens. So much of what I'm going to be speaking about owes its debt to her love and support throughout this time. Thank you all for being here. Over to the lecture then. So I came up to Cambridge to study economics in the late 1980s. And this is a moment of rising environmental consciousness. This is a moment when people are starting to think about questions about the future of life on this planet. This book, Our Common Future, the World Commission on Environment and Development, was published around that time. And I started to try and make some sense of these difficult challenges of how we could collectively organize in order to look after life on this planet, but also to ensure that people's well-being and livelihoods continued to be protected. Within the literature, there was a dominant narrative around what people have sometimes called the tragedy of the commons, a very famous piece from the 1960s. And I've picked out the quote which often people refer to, which talks about the tragedy that occurs when individual herdsmen, in this case, in the commons, choose to add cattle to the commons, thinking only about private interest and forget to recognize that the consequence of that individual decision-making is the collective ruin of the commons. So that was often called the tragedy of the commons. And within a more narrow literature, people were thinking about how can collective action be motivated? How can people work in the collective interest and overcome these pressures for individualism and individual interest? So the logic of collective action was formalized within the discipline, within economics, using game theoretic models like the prisoner's dilemma, and it showed, the prisoner's dilemma famously shows, that two prisoners, unable to communicate with each other, are forced into a situation where they take the suboptimal route of snitching on each other rather than keeping quiet. And that can be formalized mathematically, and it shows that people are often acting against their collective interest. But of course, the folk theorem was then created in order to say, actually, if people could communicate, if people could recognize that they have long-term interactions with each other, they may be able to overcome this tragedy. They may be able to actually encourage collective behavior to take place through communication, through the recognition that punishment is possible, and people might be rewarded for good behavior and punished for bad behavior. And this, of course, matched what the anthropologists had been telling us for a very long time, that actually, if you go out and look at people who do manage the commons in reality, they are often well managed. They are often sustainable. So the reality of the commons was sometimes quite different to what had been predicted in the tragedy of the commons model. And the work of people like Eleanor Ostrom, who subsequently got the Nobel Prize in Economics for her work on the commons, was also beginning to appear in the literature in the early 1990s, talking about exactly how these institutions for collective management could be supported and what kind of institutional structures were required. That's what led me into the sort of investigation which I started earliest in my academic career, which was to try and understand how the commons were being managed in India, and in particular to try and understand them in the context of the Himalayas, which is a part of the world which I did have the privilege of growing up in. And this book by Ram Guha was really influential. It's a book called The Unquiet Woods, in which he talks about the histories of resistance to the dispossession that took place in the Himalayan forests during the time of the colonial administration. And the legacies of that in terms of the contemporary issues that were being discussed in the 1980s and the 1990s. And what took place was a process of colonial reservation of forests for the interests of the colonial state, but it led to a dispossession of local communities and an alienation of local communities from access to those forests. The response was bottom-up resistance, including the very famous Chipko movement, where communities gathered around and protected the forest against the incursions of external resource exploiters. That conflict continued through that period of the 1970s and the 1980s, including partly heightened by the Forest Conservation Act that was passed with good intention to protect the forest, but led to village resource users being alienated from the forest even further. So the starting point was this attempt to try and understand the contested histories of India's forests, this process where historic access, pre-colonial access, was basically centered around customary rights. People who lived in and around villages had access to the local village forest and often had created collective institutions to sustainably manage those forests. The arrival of the external state, and in this case the colonial state, meant that there was a process of appropriation and alienation that took place. It was based on a process of what was called forest settlement, but the settlement was often incomplete, and it was often designed in ways that was not necessarily conducive to the logics that pervaded these local communities. So, for example, when forest reservation took place, communities were asked to declare themselves and identify themselves as potential rights holders. Often, the declaration would have to take place in a distant district capital, which was many miles away from the forest that the communities actually inhabited. So, firstly, the knowledge about the declaration was not available, and then the ability for people to make themselves known as potential rights holders was also not available. So the process of forest settlement was really a process of forest appropriation and expropriation by the colonial state. And the contestation that that led to over forests and land continues unto the present time. And we'll see its contemporary manifestations as well. So by the 1990s, there was a clear recognition that the conflict between local communities and the state was creating conditions in which India's forests were continually being degraded. There was no incentive for local communities to look after the forests because they were perceived as state-owned property, and people were alienated from immediate access. In response, there were a number of responses at different scales. At one level, communities self-mobilized, and the Chipko movement was one example, but there were many examples of self-mobilized communities who started to organize and take control back. There was also innovation top-down. So in the state of West Bengal, for example, from the early 1990s, quite enlightened forest officers recognized that keeping the local communities away from the forest was not really a sustainable strategy long-term. So actually trying to find ways to bring them in to partnership with state institutions and find ways to collaborate might be a more appropriate response to the challenges that were being faced. So the paradigm of participatory forestry was really born in response to this recognition that alienation was no longer going to be sustainable long-term. And by the early 1990s, there was a real shift. The Indian government launched in 1990 a program that they called Joint Forest Management, and it was designed in order to encourage collaboration between state institutions and local institutions in order to sustain forest resources. And that expanded rapidly. The international donor community loved the idea of participation. It resonated very strongly with what was by then becoming really important concerns around human rights and equity and justice. So in the 1990s, donor-funded participatory forestry, not just in India, but globally, became very much the flavor of the month. And in India, there was a rapid expansion. Estimates suggested that within about 15 years, almost 100,000 forest management committees had been set up all over the country, covering something like 21 million hectares in these participatory forest management programs. So we were studying some of these in the early part of the 2000s to try and understand, about 10 years on from the introduction of joint forest management, whether it was working, how well was it working, and what were the responses that people were suggesting in relation to this attempt to decentralize power. There's a really interesting process going on because the forest was managed by low-level forest bureaucrats, forest guards typically, who had for many generations seen the villagers as the enemy, and their entire job was designed to police the forest against the villager. You get an administrative shift, which is participatory forestry, which is very much a top-down decision. And the same forest guard who had been policing the forest for 30 years is suddenly asked to become the friend of the villager. It was quite a difficult mindset change to actually engender. And what we found is that that street-level bureaucrat became a sort of bottleneck because there was no real incentive for them to change the way in which they were behaving. We also found, as with all community management efforts, that communities are far from homogeneous. Communities are internally differentiated. There are rich and poor people within village communities. There are more powerful and less powerful people. And when an opportunity like this comes through, it was very clear that the elite were benefiting more than the poor because they were the ones who were able to control the resources. The tribal organizations that we spoke to used the analogy of a cow, which was really interesting. They said joint forest management is like a cow. We, the tribals, feed it, and the government milks it. So there was this kind of real sense that this wasn't working in the way it was originally designed and intentioned. And although it was well-intentioned to include local communities in the management of their resources, it remained a very unequal partnership because a partnership led by and controlled by the state, and the local communities weren't seen as co-equal partners. At the same time, alternative social movements had started demanding a much more profound shift in forest management, and they started to articulate the language of rights. And what they said is that this form of administrative decentralization doesn't recognize local communities as owners and rights holders. And actually, what they wanted was a recognition of their historic claims over these resources, the dispossession that had taken place 150 years ago under colonial rule was seen as the problem. This was slightly triggered by the Indian Supreme Court ordering state forest departments to remove encroachers from the forest. And overnight, people who'd been cultivating the lands got defined as encroachers because they didn't have legal title to the lands that they were cultivating. The forest rights movements mobilized in response to this and started demanding a recognition of these rights, claiming that this term encroacher was illegal, was illegitimate in the context of the history of forest settlement. And the forest rights movements eventually were able to secure a change in the legislation with the introduction of what was called the Forest Rights Act in 2006. In the preamble to the act, the Government of India recognizes the historic injustice which had resulted in the exclusion and expropriation of these lands. So that's quite a landmark recognition that there is this history and we're trying to overcome that history. So the rights-based alternatives were actually moving away from this idea of bureaucratic participation towards a much stronger claim around land rights and land claims. That was part of a much wider discussion because at the same time, this is now the early 1990s and the early 2000s, the Indian economy had started expanding, and in that boom, lands became the subject of even further contestation. There was mining activity. Most mineral deposits were found in areas that were inhabited by tribal communities and also happened to be areas that were forest dominated. Estimates suggest that something like 2 million people were displaced due to mining, but there was also other controversies that became very famous. The Narmada Dam people might have heard of, which was a big dam building movement in the central India, which also resulted in the displacement of people. And the evolution of industrialization and special economic zones was also responsible for some of these dispossessions. So a new form of dispossession taking place to promote capitalist accumulation. So land rights movements were mobilizing not just in defense of the forest, but also defending the land, the water, and the slogan of Jal, Jungle, and Zameen, which means water, forest, and land in Hindi, became a really important part of the mobilization process. And again, in response to that, partly facilitated by civil society organizations, the Government of India passed in 2013 quite a far-reaching act, which actually recognizes terms like fair compensation, transparency in the processes of land acquisition, rehabilitation, and resettlement. So again, there's a sort of really interesting shift taking place, which is recognizing the importance of people's rights in relation to the land. But we need to set that slightly in contrast with the question of what happens when you disrupt people's lives. So the quote that I've got is from the work of Amita Bhaviskar, a famous anthropologist who's worked in central India. And she's talking about the disruption that tribal communities face when they are uprooted from places that mean more than just being a place where they derive a livelihood. The link between nature and society is central to the religious beliefs of the Adivasis of the hills. The village stands in a particular relation to a specific site and to its ancestral spirits who inhabit that site. And that raises really profound questions about whether compensation is even something that we should be talking about when you're disrupting people's lives, which are so intimately tied with place. So really important challenges between the mineral wealth that these people inhabit and their rootedness in place. So the big questions that emerge from that are questions around what I've called conflict and coexistence. I've also used the example of conservation projects that I've also had quite a lot of association with. India is obviously famously known as the land of the tiger. Project Tiger is its attempt to try and protect the dwindling tiger population, which is in the low thousands at the moment. So Project Tiger has been really successful because the tiger is still not extinct, but at the same time, Project Tiger involves this conflict. Over the period since the 1970s, something like 80 villages, almost 3,000 families have been relocated from tiger reserves. And that's just a small part of the number of people who actually currently still live within tiger sanctuaries. So questions around coexistence: can people live with wild nature in these terms, or do people have to be displaced? And there are new pressures which are coming into the landscape. So under what's called the Bond Challenge, the countries of the world have decided that reforestation and afforestation strategies are a good response to climate change. Tree planting absorbs carbon, but trees need land. And in an already crowded country, where is that land? So The Indian government has pledged to restore 21 million hectares. Where are these 21 million hectares free of human interference? How are we going to find the place to actually undertake this mass-scale restoration? And the big questions there are obviously, where is the space for people to continue to thrive and for nature to survive in the 21st century? In a country like India, how do we do this? And while we do this, who are the winners and who are the losers? Who gains and who loses from these processes? The kind of deep questions of political economy. So let me try and turn to another part of my work in which might have some hope, because that was quite a depressing point to stop at. Again, in the early 2000s, a new sort of framing emerged in the literature around a term that's become far more popular than I ever thought it would. It's a term which has been derived to try and show the relationship between humans and nature. But it's captured in the term ecosystem services, and people define them as the benefits that people receive from ecosystems, from nature. And those were defined by the Millennium Ecosystem Assessment, which came out in 2005, quite an important document, but tried to map the dependencies of humanity upon nature. And ecosystem services was the terminology that was used to express that dependency. I didn't think it would have the resonance it did, but it does. It frames a lot of work in our world and in the fields that I work in. And it's started to become a way of saying, let's recognize the hidden contributions that nature makes to people's well-being. And if we recognize this, then some of the conflicts that I was talking about might not be conflicts after all. That then resulted in a lot of work trying to put values on some of these relationships. The UK tried to do this with something called the UK National Ecosystem Assessment. And these are some of the headlines that came out around the time that the UK National Ecosystem Assessment was launched, which was in 2011, talking about nature being worth billions. Anyway, so trying to reframe the relationship in ways that I think, in good faith, people hoped that the economic decision makers would stand up and take notice. So what they were hoping is by putting these values out there, economic decision makers would start to recognize the values that humanity derives from nature. Of course, there were debates around that. George Monbiot famously said, the true value of nature is not a number with a pound sign in front. So obviously this discussion about whether putting money values is the best way to make decisions about nature was part of this discussion. There was also ways that people tried to operationalize some of this understanding of ecosystem services. And this diagram tries to show you one such attempt. And this is trying to recognize that in a watershed, typically, you have an upstream area, which is typically where the watershed is. And you have people lower down the watershed who are beneficiaries, who benefit from the flow of water through gravity in that watershed. Now, what happens in the upper areas therefore impacts the well-being of people in the lower areas. And there's a hydrological connectivity between the upstream and the downstream. And what people do in the upstream therefore starts to matter to the stakeholders in the downstream. Payments for ecosystem services became this paradigm which was saying, if we can find ways that the downstream beneficiaries of ecosystem services pay the upstream providers of ecosystem services, you can create a sort of win-win situation. Because the downstream beneficiaries will get more water, the upstream beneficiaries will get rewarded for managing their ecosystem in a better way, and that creates the win-win possibilities. So this is what some people started to call incentive-based environmental management, trying to reward upstream managers in a watershed to provide clean drinking water. One of the most famous examples was New York City. So New York City gets its water from the Catskills. The Catskills are protected by this kind of a payment for ecosystem services program, and New York City doesn't use any artificial filtration for its water. It gets clean drinking water because the watershed is well protected. So that example was then replicated in a number of places, especially in the global south, and in Latin America, a huge program to try and increase these water funds, as they started to be called, getting municipalities to pay upstream resource users and give them a positive incentive to look after their forests rather than to engage in destructive activity. So there's a kind of interesting win-win scenario. So we said, let's have a look at this. Two lovely sets of slides with photographs from my colleague Toby Smith. So we had the privilege to work together, and we've done some photography exhibitions, so I couldn't resist the excuse to put some of his pictures up. So credits for this slide and the next slide are very much Toby's. We said we'd try and have a look at this in the Himalayan forest. So this takes me back to the Himalayas. And people had heard about these payments for ecosystem services schemes and said, let's see whether these work in the Indian and Nepalese context. And we started to explore the trade-offs between the different uses of water within a watershed. Water itself is a contested resource. So the downstream users in this case were often small towns. Urbanization is taking place quite rapidly, and small settlements are becoming peri-urban or urban, and they're extracting resources like water from the landscape. The upstream users continue to need water too. So agriculture is changing. Agriculture is becoming more dependent on water. Cash cropping is becoming very important. People are growing vegetables in the upstream. Water itself is a contested resource. So it's not like the upstream doesn't have needs for water. The contestation then becomes a contest between often quite wealthy downstream townspeople and not as wealthy upstream villagers. How do we then manage that power dynamic? And how do we try and create mechanisms for intervention that don't disproportionately reward the rich and not recognize the needs of the poor? So while payments for ecosystem services in theory sound like a good idea because of this win-win, the power dynamics don't disappear. The inequalities don't disappear. And that's really what the research was able to focus on. And really drawing away from that, the sort of larger conclusions are that the management of ecosystems is always going to involve winners and losers. Win-win for me is very elusive. It almost never happens. And what we need to do is to understand and study the beneficiaries and the losers, try and understand in a political economy sense the winners and losers from these processes, and recognize the social and economic inequalities that shape the structures in which these decisions are being made. So the questions that have animated this work are about who gets to decide, whose voice actually does count, and which types of values matter. There was also a sort of further critique, which is we were creating a market logic to define relationships that had historically been defined in other ways. Social reciprocity was being trumped by market relations. And around this time, Michael Sandel, who's a Harvard philosopher, wrote this book called The Moral Limits of Markets. And again, I thought it would be nice to take a quote. He's talking about pollution markets, global pollution permits, and international trading in pollution. And he says the moral problem with a global market is the outsourcing of the obligation. Where global cooperation is at stake, allowing rich countries to avoid meaningful reductions in their own energy use by buying the right to pollute from others, or paying for programs that enable other countries to pollute less, does damage to two norms. It entrenches an instrumental attitude towards nature, and it undermines the spirit of shared sacrifice that may be necessary to create a global environmental ethic. We need to think about flying less, not offsetting our flights. And that's really what he's trying to talk about. Can we think about this environmental ethic which goes beyond these instrumental human-centric values? So we've been doing a bit of work trying to think about that, trying to redefine the ways in which we measure poverty and try and recognize that our relationships with nature shape our very sense of self. They go beyond the instrumental values that nature provides. People's lives and the environment are intimately connected. And even though we recognize the dependence on instrumental values like food, some of that is quite neglected. But nature matters often in a much more fundamental, constitutive sense of self. It goes back to the quote that from the people who were writing about the tribal economies of central India. People are rooted in place, and that shapes their sense of self. Can we find ways to include that in our measures of poverty and well-being? That sense of rootedness, that sense of belonging, more than just the instrumental values that shape our relationships. We're getting better at the instrumental, but we might be neglected some of these deeper spiritual values. We've been trying to do some of that work along with colleagues in the Cambridge Conservation Initiative around natural capital, and can the values of biodiversity be better reflected in the ways in which we measure natural capital? Natural capital, again, is something which has become a very dominant way of framing the relationship between humans and nature. One of the observations that we made was that for a lot of people, what matters is the intact stock of nature, if you want to call it that. Not so much the flow of benefits that we get from nature. That's the instrumental dimension of what nature does for people. But what we care about is the ability to walk in a wild landscape. We want to value nature in its intact sense rather than monetizing it or instrumentalizing it in terms of the flows that it gives us. So this piece of work is trying to understand, can we find ways for those stock values, which is what we really care about, to be better reflected in the way in which we value nature? And that resonates with recent work, allows me to bring the fens in. So this is the government's 25-year plan. The 25-year environment plan was launched by the government earlier this year. It makes an intergenerational pledge, which is a really powerful one, promising to leave the environment in a better state than we found it. But it's a state pledge. It's a stock-related pledge. We want to leave it better, and we need to find ways to measure what better means. It's underpinned by a natural capital approach. It talks about the importance of local management. So they talk about something called a system operator. Local areas should be managed as a system with a system operator responsible for the strategic management of natural capital in accordance with local plans. And the questions it's asking are about balancing the productive versus the protective functions of the landscape. They're returning me right back to the question of how do we manage the commons? How should these resources be managed? What are the right institutional structures to manage these resources? And these questions are being asked in all sorts of ways. We've got some work which is taking place with Wiccan as an example, which has a very ambitious plan for its long-term vision for the Fenlands. Can we embed these natural capital principles better in these sorts of management systems? So I'll leave you with a few questions. Can we make decisions without necessarily reducing them to the logic of price? Some of the things that we're talking about are non-marginal changes. The price system is really good when you're making a marginal choice. But actually, we're making some pretty fundamental questions about how we live and what choices we make as humanity. How can these discussions about environment and development learn from the profound shifts that have taken place in social organization? How can we learn about things like universal suffrage, the abolition of slavery, child labor, gender equality? We didn't conduct a marginal cost-benefit analysis in order to understand whether we should take those steps. We thought they were morally right, and we took those steps. How can we learn from that when we think about debates about environment and development? What are the decisions that society is willing to make beyond having to justify them on the basis of economic value? And if there are such decisions, is nature part of that decision framework? So leaving you with my final slide on moving towards a political economy of environment and development. Bringing some of these ideas together, what I'm saying is that the environment is viewed, perceived, valued in multiple ways by different stakeholders. Environmental change, we've seen, often involves the unequal distribution of costs and benefits. We really need to center stage, recognize the importance of rights, of fairness, of equity and justice. It's not just about compensating people in a monetary sense, it's recognizing their fundamental claims to the places that they belong to. We need to recognize that when we intervene, we are often creating winners and losers at different scales, and we need to understand the dynamism of that change. So really what I'm talking about is moving towards an explicitly political, a socially engaged approach to making these difficult choices. And these are difficult choices. There are no easy win-wins. Thank you very much.